C-158. Number 8A.
The second part, see, wants to show that we should never believe in a belief. But what she says, that mortal mind reading can only present primal facts to mortal mind. A mortal mind reading, therefore, never can unlock the treasures of truth, can never read truth. So it has no Christ, it has no saving effect. And these seven subjects really are seven subjects which, when we deal with a problem, we have to remember, because they ask us first, in the first subject, not to believe into what mortal mind and human mind says. Second, it says, don't believe in the cooperation of mind and matter, mortal mind and matter. Because the belief is always that because of some thinking, matter has responded so and so, that there is a cooperation between mortal mind and matter. That because wrong thinking has gone on, it has cooperated with matter. There is only the control of the divine mind. And it says in the third, don't believe in the sense testimony. Don't believe in sense testimony. In the fourth, it says, don't believe in human doctrines and formulated beliefs. And in the fifth, it says, don't believe in extraordinary phenomena, in extraordinary situations. Everything is very natural in science, really. And it says in the sixth, don't believe that the belief is conscious of its whole belief. Don't believe that a patient or somebody tells the whole truth about that belief, the whole content of that belief. Never. The more I see, the less I believe in what somebody says about belief, about the situation. Because as she shows, it can never unearth the true facts. It only can unearth that which is that the conscious mortal mind is only conscious of the conscious beliefs, never of the subconscious beliefs. And lastly, I think it is very important to see that we don't believe in any so-called wonder, because most of what the world calls wonders are just those, as Mrs. Eddy shows them in that seventh subject, they are wonders only to mortal belief, but not real wonders. So, having uncovered in that second part how we can distinguish between the realm of belief and the realm of the mind Christ, to distinguish that which is from God alone has a Christ, and that which is from mortals, from the mortal mind, has no divine Christ. Having uncovered that properly, then naturally the question put before us is, now which side do I take? And if I choose the side of the divine mind, well, have I a chance to succeed? Because the human mind will come in and say, well, it is impossible that you can be the Son of God and experience the Son of God. All the arguments come up of mortal mind which wants us to convince that the task is too difficult, That's what the first subject says in the third part. It says the task is too difficult, you can't succeed. In the second one, it argues and says, after all, you are already a material personality, you can never become a spiritual personality, because as Mrs. Eddy has said, matter cannot be turned into spirit, so you can never spiritualize. Very cunning argument, very, very subtle argument. And goes on and says, well, after all, evil is just as real as good, and it just seems to be as powerful as good. I don't think you will have the inward strength to succeed. And so it goes on and on through that third subject, trying to show us that it is not possible. And on the other hand, Mrs. Eddy gives the true method and shows, well, the true method is that we don't try to come out of the realm of human belief into the realm of science. There is no upward working from mortal mind to divine mind. The only real method you can choose is that you admit to yourself right from the start, right from the beginning, that you are God's own likeness, and that standpoint sets you free to master the infinite idea. It sets us free for true spiritualization. And shows then in the third part that if we take that standpoint consciously, scientifically, that then in the line of spiritual development, by using the means that they are given there, namely by denying material selfhood, by rejecting the arguments of the serpent in a belief of good and evil, by broadening out our vision to the man that is already as big as God in quality, though not in quantity, and that in broadening out that vision we can see that we are able to bring out the best and always the best, that we can never do harm, that it will never do us any harm to take such an attitude, and that we will win through in the sixth subject and in the seventh subject, that is a way of salvation which is scientific, and that we shouldn't sidestep that way. I don't want to go further into the details because the subject is rather new to us still, because we have only taken it a short time ago. But to see the connection is the main thing between these parts. Now, let's just see again in a big line these three parts, what they really want to show in its depth. The first part shows a pure analysis that spirit only identifies itself spiritually, never in a duality, whatever that duality may be. It always identifies it spiritually, that it manifests itself as spiritual identities of being, never as anything which is humanly conceived. So that is the first part, says that spirit identifies itself only spiritually. And that uncovers naturally in us that only that mind in us which is in rapport with this spirit, with this standpoint of spirit, that only that mind which is in one with spirit that is only the true mind. That is only the true mind. Truth as mind, the second part. See? And as we begin to see that only that mind, which is in communion, that only that mind which is in communion with spirit, that mind is only the true mind, and that mind is only the mind of Christ. If we see that and accept that, that naturally unlocks the treasures of truth. Through that mind, we really then look into reality and become aware of truth, of the real truth. And becoming aware of the real truth, then the third part shows, because the life-giving quality of mind is spirit, that as this mind is in rapport with spirit, that attitude can really spiritualize. So the third part shows the spiritualization of such a mind. Can you see the three parts? Once again, the big question of the whole fourth chapter is monotheism. And the question for us, that if God is only one God, it must be spirit. The question for us arises in our approach, which are still in the word chapters, in our approach to the one spirit, how can we break through the matter barrier? How can we break through that veil of matter into the realm of spirit? The most important and imminent problem of this age. It says, first, you have to be clear what is real. What is this one spirit and the spiritual universe? And so, in the first part, presents first the purity of spirit and the monism of that spiritual universe. But it says, but how can you get there? That's now a picture, that's now an analysis from the standpoint of the world, but how can you get there? Well, to get there is not to get to a place, but to get there in consciousness. How can we get there in consciousness? We can only get there in consciousness if our mind is brought in rapport with that divine mind, with that spirit. If our mind is brought in rapport with what has been presented in the first part, then our mind is in rapport with that which is spirit, and not with that which is of the nature of belief. And being in rapport with that which is spirit, we have found the divine mind. And in the measure as we have found the divine mind always spiritualizes us. That's the third part. Then spiritualization is possible. Then we are not trying to spiritualize matter, and we are not trying to spiritualize the human mind. But then, you see, the crux, the turning point seems to be the second part. The second part is the decision. Do we bring our mind in line with what the human mind tells us? Do we bring our mind in line with what the realm of the human mind contains? Or do we bring our mind in line with spirit, God? Then that mind becomes divine mind-like. It is then of the nature of the divine mind and becomes divine mind-like. And we take the divine mind-like standpoint. And then, having taken that divine mind-like standpoint, having accepted for ourselves that we are God's image and likeness, then the third part shows that such a mind always is unfolding in the line of spirit. That always spiritualizes us. Always. That's the Christianity sense of it. So that the more we use the second part as that which tries to bring our thought and action and affection and purpose in line with the first part, which shows the realm of spirit, the monotheism of spirit, the uniqueness and onlyness of spirit, that in that measure we are one with spirit, and in the measure as we are one in spirit, the third part spiritualizes us always. And that brings us through that matter barrier into the realm of spirit. I feel that this order has to be considered over and over and over again. Because the problem which is set is the problem which every one of us is concerned with. Namely, how can we become more spiritual? What is the process of spiritualization? And in practically all religions, the method of spiritualization is tried out on a basis of trying to spiritualize matter, to spiritualize the human mind or mortal mind. Whereas here, it's very different. Here it is a change of standpoint which is asked. It is first asked in the first part to take the standpoint of God first, instead of men, of the human mind. First, in divine logic, she speaks about divine logic. First, in divine logic, see what God's universe is. Then in the second part, change the standpoint from belief in the human mind and in mortal mind, a change to lining our concept, our mind, our thinking, lining it up with the divine mind, with that which has been presented in the first part. And by making this change of standpoint to the standpoint of divine mind, we partake of the divine mind and all what the divine mind contains. And that spiritualizes. That always spiritualizes. And the third part shows the line of spiritualization the moment we admit to ourselves that man is God's own light. Third part really is very big in depth and in consequences. And so we have gone over the first four chapters. And in one way it's quite interesting to see the beginning and the end of this four chapter as a whole. Because the beginning of this four chapter, namely God, namely prayer, shows in the very first pages that prayer is praying to God as He is and leave the reward to God and let God determine the reward He wants to give. That was the first subject, to seek and desire to know God as He is and accept the reward that God determines as a reward. And when we come to the last subject of the fourth chapter on spiritualism, she speaks about that reward again and shows the reward we have gained by going through these four chapters. And she speaks there about that earth has no repayment for a new step in Christianity. We come to the reward. First it says, earth doesn't give us any reward. But what the four chapters want us to give is to take away the earth. And earth does not give us any reward. But the spiritual recompense, now we get the real reward, the spiritual recompense of the persecuted is assured in what? In the elevation of existence above mortal discord. And in the gift of divine love. And then she goes on and shows what this gift of divine love is through the seven subtones of the last subject. And shows that that gift is the idea that we gain, that through these four chapters we gain the gift of divine love. Well, love is never loses sight of loveliness. Love is never without its idea, without its expression. What she shows there is that we gain the idea of mind, that we gain the idea of spirit, our spiritual insight, that we gain the idea of soul, namely a sense of an inviolate standpoint, you see. That we gain the idea of principle, namely the unity of science and religion. I think that this problem of the unity of science and the religion is the problem of this century, of the next 50 years. I believe it. It has all to do with that tone of truth and love in the development of the spiritual idea, of the matrix that opens its womb and brings forth the calculus. And that calculus is always showing the matrix and the calculus, the unity of science and religion. Of religion, true religion bringing forth science, the calculus. And then she shows that we gain the idea of life. The idea of life, as she says, the way through which immortality and life are learned is not ecclesiastical, but Christian. That was prayer. Not human, but divine. That was atonement and Eucharist. Not physical, but metaphysical. That was marriage. Not material, but scientifically spiritual. Christian Science versus Spiritualism, the fourth chapter. We gain the idea of life, the way of life, the true idea of the method of life. That's the recompense which we gain. Now, if people say, well, what are the fruits of our labor? Well, these are fruits of our labor, that we know the way. Ye know the way, go ye the way. If the disciples would have known the way, they would have rejoiced. And now we know it, why don't we rejoice and say, do we have fruits? It's killing the child if we do that. And then she says that we have gained the idea of truth, that truth, that she says there, that we have gained the key to the kingdom. And with this key, Christian Science has opened the door of the human understanding. It's interesting to see she only uses human understanding twice in the textbook and both time in the word chapters. Because the word chapters are those which open the human understanding. They speak to the human standpoint and show us the way to God. Then when the Christ chapter opens, then the windows of heaven are opened as a revelation. And in the lastly she says what we have gained, the idea of love. Namely, that it is all-inclusive. That in our love we can include spiritualists, that we can include theosophists, that we can include hypnotists, that our contest is with the system, not with people. And that is so important to see that, and Gordon Brown makes quite a wonderful point out of that, so satisfying in his last book, that he shows, and really what here Mrs. Eddy shows, that we must see that our effort is to see the signs of Christianity and not converting people to become Christian scientists. That it is not a matter of conversion. That all what is at this moment necessary is to see that we have one world, one universe. And that what is going on either as Catholicism or Protestantism or as Mohammedanism or as Buddhism or Hinduism, what is going on as capitalism or communism, what is going on as this or that culture, that they are only misconception of a true conception. And whatever that misconception may be, they all have to put right through translation. That's why afterwards came the chapters on translation. And that is what is needed today. And not to convert the one to the other, but to see in consciousness that we include all of them. She says, I love mankind. And that those individuals who adopt theosophy, spiritualism, or hypnotism may possess natures far above others who eschew their false belief. Therefore, my contest is not with the individual, but with the false system. Well, the false system is not personal. The false system is a false concept of the divine system. We don't have to quarrel with the Muslims and with the Jews and so on, but with a system, a false system. So she goes on, I love mankind and shall continue to labor and to endure. You see, that's the end of the whole gain, what she has gained, that she loves mankind, all mankind. It's all inclusive. But what has to be set right, definitely, is all our misconceptions of all misconceptions. And that brings us into the true sense of science. So, here we are with these four chapters, and looking over these four chapters, perhaps we could ask some of the most pertinent questions of each chapter. For instance, in prayer, we could ask the pertinent question, why are our prayers not answered? Why is it that my prayer is not answered? There is a principle of prayer, so they should be answered. And so we can see that they may not be answered because we don't pray aright, because we pray amiss. And what does that mean? Well, that means that our mind is not brought in line with the right goal. But our mind is not set right. Or in the second chapter, perhaps the pertinent question we can ask is, why don't I make more progress? And the answer there is always, well, it is because I haven't exemplified enough of the Christ spirit to put first things first, to put Christ before Caesar. So that that question of growth, the second cycle, the second phase of the cycle of Atonement and Eucharist, says, why don't I progress more in science? And the answer she gives there is that, well, because you have not exemplified more of the Christ spirit. It's always there where we ask ourselves, well, have I really put everything into it? Or in marriage, the question she speaks about there about happy relationship and so on, that I could ask myself, why am I not more happy? Why don't I get a greater kick out of life than I do? Why is my life not joyous and happy? And the answer is there in soul, that she says, well, because I'm too selfish. Because only selflessness really is that which opens up the unity of interest, mutuality, where I can take part in the whole, in the unlimited, in the free, and where therefore all is at my disposition, where everything serves me and contributes to my happiness just as I contribute to everybody's happiness. So it is usually always a sense of being too much concerned with oneself, with one's own problem, making so much, too much out of one's own difficulties, instead of saying, oh, well, they are so insignificant compared with what the world needs. If we would just forget our little difficulties and put them aside and turn towards the big interest in the world and put ourselves into the service of the whole and of the big and of the essential, all these little difficulties would just vanish away. And our life would be more abundant and freer and more spontaneous, and we jolly well would get quite a kick out of our life. Or take the fourth chapter and asking us what is the question that the fourth chapter really would put, namely the fourth chapter is a chapter which says there is one principle, and the principle is spiritual, there is only one spiritual universe, that's the only true universe that there is, that there is the real universe. That universe is complete and good. And the question which we so often ask in this respect is, but why doesn't the world really adopt quicker and more Christian Science? Why doesn't the world see clearer what Christian Science is? Why doesn't Christian Science make more progress in the world? And at once we see what spiritualists we are. We want to have Christian Science in the world instead of out of the world. Jesus said, I'm no more of this world. He left the world behind. And the answer there is, well, it is because our standpoint is not in principle. Because if our standpoint would be in principle, if we really would sit down on the throne of grace, we could only see one world. We could only see one world and would never ask such a stupid question, why doesn't the world accept Christian Science? We wouldn't. We wouldn't. And so the point is that we ask this question because we ourselves have two worlds. Have the world of spirit and the world of matter. The world of God and the world of the world. And want to reconcile them and want to turn the world, transform the world into spirit. Instead of seeing that the world is a belief, a misconception. It's a conception of a misconception. Take of a misstatement, taking a standpoint outside of God, and we see the world. If we want to see the world, we can see it in the moment we take a standpoint outside of principle. Then we see the world. And in no other way can we see the world. We can never see capitalism and communism, Jesuitism and Catholicism, Judaism and Muslimism and Hinduism, Buddhism and I don't know what. We can never see that except we take a standpoint outside of God. Then we see it. But when we take a standpoint of principle, then principle only interprets itself and sees itself, and then there is no more a question, why doesn't the world accept Christians? I was very impressed always about John Dolly's last few verbatim reports. I was unaware what was going on in his personal life, but when I received those last reports, I felt something had changed in his whole attitude to present the subject. And the whole attitude there was, why don't we go into the city and stay in the city? And when we are in the city, we can look around and we only see the four walls of the city, the world, Christ, Christianity, and science. And there is no more world. Somehow he has touched that point in those last verbatim reports. I always said, if we take the standpoint of science, we are no more asking this question about the world. Why doesn't the world take science? Science is self-sufficient in itself. It's coherent in itself. It's consistent in itself. And it doesn't need an acceptance of the world or of the devil. God doesn't need that the devil accepts God. God is self-existent and self-expressed by itself. The point is that we don't go and sit down on the throne of God, that we stay outside the city and therefore have on one side the city and on the other side we have the world. But Jesus said, I'm not of this world. He wasn't concerned if the world would accept him or not. He knew that science is science and that science is in itself demonstrating itself.